Hello, everybody. It's Jeremy Swenson. I am the CEO of Abstract Forward Consulting. We are a cybersecurity process improvement and change management consulting firm, and this is our podcast where we discuss related topics and current event items and interview thought leaders. Today in the studio, we have Jay Jacobs. He is the former data analyst and key contributing writer to the Verizon Data Breach Incident Report. We're going to be interviewing him today and talking about data analytics, some of the financial estimates of costs concerning data breaches and related topics. So with that, I'd like Jay to go ahead and give a good description of his company, and we'll go with the interview from there.
All right. Well, thanks for having me, Jeremy. So I am a data scientist working at Scientia Institute. And Scientia Institute is in the short form, or just a research firm. And so companies will hire us to typically look at the data that they've collected and try to make sense of it, and oftentimes produce some sort of public-facing report or research publication or something for them. We've got another part of the company where we're working on what we call our library, and we're gathering up all of the reports in the industry, both from vendors and from academia, and trying to parse through those and make those essentially searchable and have the information that's being published in there hopefully aggregated up. And that's what we're working on right now. And if you go to our website at scientia.com, that's C-Y-E-N-T-I-A.com, you can see there's a library link, and you can basically search now and identify some of the topics in different documents, but we don't have all of that functionality up there yet. It's something we're working towards.
Wow. Well, that's a great introduction. There's a huge need for a company like yours. And I know you really did this with a lot of experience and knowledge from Verizon and related companies. I guess my first question for you is, in your mind, what is the current state of big data or machine learning? Where have we come in the last recent number of years?
Well, the topic, without any security connotation to it, just talking about big data, machine learning, AI, all these things sort of are talking about the similar topic. It's really, really exciting. I mean, just ignoring the security stuff right now and how it applies to security, just the field of machine learning, AI, the data engineering stuff, big data, it's just been moving at light speeds. And it's just been really, really interesting to be a part of that and to watch things, you know, change and evolve. You know, like AI and some of the deep learning stuff, it's changing almost monthly. And so to keep up on that is a huge challenge. And then to throw in the mix that we're trying to figure out all that stuff and then apply it to a specific domain like security just makes it so much more interesting on top of that, where security is generally a fast moving pace when you're trying to talk about, you know, intrusion detection and things like that. But when you're looking at large strategic aspects of security, it's a little bit more slow moving. You know, when you're looking at breach trends and things like that, it's a little bit more slow moving.
The one thing I hear from CIOs and CISOs is that the data analytics and even the machine learning isn't good enough to remove a considerable degree of false positives. So if we talk about a SIEM, Security Incident Event Management tool, what I'm hearing is that CISOs are overwhelmed with the amount of alerts, and there's still a ton of false positives. And they believe that a lot of these vendor tools that are using machine learning, it's more hype than it is reality. So my question is, what is it going to take for us to be able to have a tool that can truly, with a high degree of accuracy, identify true positives, save time, and, you know, mitigate some of these network intrusion and data breach type activities?
So the thing about all of that is that a lot of the current technology used for detecting intrusions and things like that, it's been basically built on what's called anomaly detection. And it's a form of unsupervised learning, meaning they're taking a lot of data, trying to figure out what normal looks like, and then identifying things that are not normal. And so when you're talking about SEMs and log management and these alerts coming up, all they can do is say this one is out of the norm, right? And so that's where all this false positive comes in. The way we're going to improve that is essentially moving to what's called a supervised model. And this is just a whole class of machine learning algorithms where essentially you're taking historical data and you're saying, here are the ones that were not false positives. These were true positives and these were false positives. These are, you know, not malicious. And you get all of this labeled data, and that labeled data is what's going to be able to tell us how good these are actually performing, tracking over time, and help us build much better algorithms to help detect that. But beyond that, I think that security, beyond the very operations center application of machine learning and AI and things like that. I think beyond that, we've got a whole huge world in security to really apply these things that are not about catching the one bad guy today. It's more about trying to understand how are we spending, how are our teams performing, where is our budget being allocated, where is the best way to spend money to reduce the amount of exposure that companies are seeing. And that's a much different problem than saying, let's look at the packets and try to figure out where the bad guys are.
So good reporting, good metrics, clean data. I mean, I can see that's where you could help out, especially a large, complex organization, where if you can come in and say, we're going to come up with a methodology to clean your data to help you move through this data. Maybe it's looking at logs, but there's a lot of data that, you know, if you clean it up and organize it in a good way, you're going to be able to get intelligible information to make security and business processes decisions. The whole question of, is that going to allow you to catch network penetration or data exfiltration? That's a whole different question.
Right. Yeah, I have an example for you. So we're working with a company called Kenna Security, and they essentially do vulnerability management. So companies, when they're doing vulnerability management, they will scan their infrastructure looking for vulnerabilities. And what they get out of these scans is a large collection of findings. So they will literally get thousands, even hundreds of thousands of findings, and they have to prioritize it. Right. And so what Kenna does is that they've been tracking this stuff now for a few years, and they can look, they've been tracking what vulnerabilities have had exploits published in the wild. And they have devices and sensors, and they're getting data from partners saying, here's what's actually being exploited. And so now they've got labeled data, going back to that labeled data set. They have, here's all the vulnerabilities that are being tracked. They focus on the CVE process, which is the vulnerability enumeration out there. And they look at that and say, out of all these things that have been identified, what are actually being exploited and what traits do those have? And so now what they can do is build a model that can help companies prioritize how they remediate these vulnerabilities. Because no company can take that list and be like, all right, we'll have this done by next Wednesday. You know, it's just not going to happen. And so companies have to prioritize and say, we're going to take off the worst 10% of these that we can, and we're going to address those first. And so that prioritization mechanism is a huge, huge deal. And what we found when we looked at the data is that the current mechanisms out there, there's something called the CVSS scoring mechanism, which scores vulnerabilities. That is actually a very, very poor mechanism when used for prioritization. It's actually almost no better than random chance. And that's one of the things we looked at. We looked at these strategies and looked at it compared to random chance. And a lot of them were right in line, or perhaps in some cases even worse than just random chance.
Well, take the Equifax breach, right? So that was a known vulnerability that was disclosed and had a CVE number associated with it.
Yep.
And Equifax knew about that well ahead of time.
Right.
What it looks like they didn't prioritize that as something to patch.
Right.
And you start to wonder, well, why was that? But to them, they may have had other things that they needed to patch. And it's hard for a company to know what to patch amid a number of patches and tools in a number of attack surface vectors. That's a really hard situation to resolve. Clearly, they made a mistake. That was one they should have patched, and they're now paying the price for it. But I guess I'd like to go back to your earlier experience from the Verizon Data Breach Report and just say, what are the top three things that you learned and you think mid-sized companies should take away from the Verizon Data Breach Report process?
Yeah, so one of the big things I learned actually wasn't directly from the data. It was from people working with the data, interpreting the data. And one of the big things is that the world of security and trying to figure out what we're going to do in security is an incredibly complex problem. There are so many moving parts. And one of the biggest things is that our intuition in this is not as reliable as people believe. And so I'm thinking of, you know, these processes of trying to rate risk, or, you know, go through policy exceptions or whatever you're trying to go through to try and rate a risk. What we see on the ground, what we see in the data is very, very different than what people are talking about in these risk meetings. And so thinking that you can just work in security and understand, be good at assessing risk just by looking at something, I don't think that's the case. I think that we have to have data, we have to have that exposure. And that's one of the things that the DBIR really helped shape, because, you know, I'm sure that you've read that year after year, and you look at that and you're like, wow, I didn't understand that aspect. I didn't realize it was that bad, say, in that particular industry. Or, you know, I thought this would really show up a lot more, and it just wasn't. I mean, there are a lot of surprises just sort of going through it like that, that the data helps shine a light on.
Right, right. So financial services and healthcare, two companies I've worked in and consulted mm-hmm. for a lot. They are top number one and two industries for data exfiltration as well as for ransomware. What are your thoughts on the current state of the ransomware threat?
So ransomware, we actually did a really interesting meta-analysis around ransomware, trying to look at prevalence and things like that. And you mentioned, you know, like healthcare, definitely in the headlines for ransomware. And there was a very famous one out in California, I think, a large healthcare institute that was crippled by ransomware. But essentially what we found is that the data on that is not consistent. When you look at the ratings of industries, healthcare sometimes is at the top and sometimes it's not at the top, depending on the type of data collected, how they collected it, so on and so forth. And so it's very difficult to say, here's the one that's actually being affected. But it's also interesting that the data collection in there is really terrible.
Now that you're away from Verizon and you know about other breach reports, you know, there's the Symantec one, there's a Bitdefender, there's a number of other breach type reports.
Hundreds.
And it's good when you're doing research and consulting to not just reference the Verizon report, but also reference many others and come to independent conclusions about, you know, what is going on and how does that apply to your industry. But what are some of the things that a report like Verizon lacked?
I mean, every report has its flaws. Verizon has, I would consider both a good thing and a bad thing, but when they're doing data collection, it's anonymized. So they will have a breach report saying victim unknown had this experience, and they hope to get as much detail about that as possible. But so one of the bad things is that by doing that, they get a lot of data. But the bad part is that they cannot tie it to other data sources. It's very difficult to take anonymized breach data and then get another data set, say, you know, of companies and the services they're exposing to the internet, and being able to say, companies with these types of services exposed experience more data breaches. You can't do that. There's no correlation because there's no tying identification to company, their configuration, their settings, their decisions that they've made, what led them to this point, and the outcome of a breach. And so that's one of the things that somewhat limits that data set. And so I think that's definitely one of the limiting things. But it also gives a lot of freedom because a lot of people are more willing to share data if it's anonymized, so on and so forth.
Got it. Makes perfect sense. So we both have experience with the Ponemon IBM mm-hmm. cost of a data breach study.
And we know it's not perfect.
Which was released recently. And one of the new findings is that the cost for the average data breach is $148 per compromised record. And that's up 4.8% from the prior year, 2017. What do you think is a factor in the cost going up?
To be totally honest, I think it's bad statistics and causing that to go up. I don't think that is a valid statistic. I don't think it's something that people should use or rely on. I did, in the 2015 DBIR, I did some research on that where I had, I think, 191 insurance claims looking at what people are claiming on their insurance and aspects of that breach and things like that, and the number of records compromised, things like that. And the correlation between the cost per record and the size of the breach was huge. In other words, small breaches had a really high cost per record, and large breaches had like pennies per record.
There's a gap with the mega breaches and the ability to quantify the cost per record. So I understand that, you know, the Yahoo breach, it's in the multi-million record number, mm-hmm. and it's hard to quantify what that cost is going to be, especially with ongoing litigation. It affected the M&A type of valuations that are associated with Yahoo. So those types of things are ongoing. But another statistic from the Ponemon IBM study is that it's taking longer for data breaches to be detected. So 196 days on average to identify that a breach had occurred versus 190.7 days in 2017. What do you think is attributed to this?
Unfortunately, I have to say bad statistics again. So the durations like that often have a long tail to them. In other words, like there's probably, you know, 30-40% of those events are captured within the first month or two. Then you get this long tail going out years. And so when people look at this distribution without understanding this long tail effect, they'll take just the mean, the average, right? And what happens on a long curve like that, there's going to be a few events out there that are years out that will have a huge impact on that average. And so without taking account for this long tail distribution, you get these weird fluctuations that have absolutely no meaning in the actual detection rate. And so I think for most of Ponemon's work, I think that's what we're seeing is just, but, and when you say it goes from 196 to 190, I mean, is that actually significant or is that just random noise year to year? I mean, if we assume that everything else is valid, that may just be just random noise.
196 from 190 is not huge, but I think right. The broader point here is it's still too long. I mean, even if we go with 180 days to know that you've been breached, that's too long. So if we talk about the Equifax breach, which I wrote a couple of blog posts about that, one when it first happened, where I went over five things they could have done better to prevent the breach. And then after the fact, I wrote a piece about the two individuals who were prosecuted and some of the conflict of interest that were there with LifeLock and Equifax. It's a huge problem. But in your view, what do you think organizations need to know to be able to reduce this time to discovering a breach or network penetration? Because this is something that's near and dear to my heart. And we at Abstract Forward, you know, we're advising CIOs, CISOs on some of the policy procedures, some of the training, and some of the disruptive change management type approaches that they need to embrace to be able to be equipped to identify these breaches sooner. But from a reporting and a data standpoint, what do you think the top three things an executive needs to be monitoring for to identify those sooner?
So I think we looked at that every year when I was working on the DBIR, and the leading way that companies actually discovered a breach was an external force. So typically law enforcement would reach out and say, you know, hey, we've been tracking this, hacking group, and we saw them connecting up to your network. You may want to go double check. Or another common thing was for a common point of purchase, right? When credit cards are compromised and they realize that a ton of them came from this retail chain or something. And so there's this external notification. So knowing that a lot of that comes from external notification, essentially companies are completely missing it. You know what I mean? Like they have no idea what's going on. And so essentially a lot of companies are at a point of no information. Certainly the mid and small size companies are there, and some larger ones are definitely moving towards getting a lot more information. Then you've got the problem of you've got too much information, you got all the false positives going on. But and I think since we're at that stage, I think a lot of ground can be gained by a few simple things. And it's going to be, you know, looking towards, I guess, the SIEM and things like that. But I haven't given that much thought, but I'm pretty sure that there's going to be a lot of ground made in the mid-tier market, especially in trying to detect some of these things.
Absolutely. I want to change the conversation a little bit to disruptive technology and ruffling the feathers of those who hold power in the CIO chain of command. Oftentimes, there is this notion of if you're not at that level, you can't ask questions. If you're not at that level, your technologies are not going to be taken seriously. Yet throughout history, what we found is those in technology who have disrupted, they have been those not from that level. They have been a creative person who takes a chance, who has an idea, who, you know, sort of takes some sort of experiment. So right now, when I look at the marketplace, things I think about that are on the cusp of innovation and security, I think about blockchain and how that can be applied to security as a commercialized product to make things better. I think about artificial intelligence, which we already talked about, and we know that there's some limitations with that. It's not fully as mature as it could be. But in your mind, what sort of disruptive technologies are on the cusp that if we continue to focus on and discuss are going to help the security dilemma?
So I think, you know, just my world is mainly machine learning and AI and data science. And so I can talk to that. And I think that we're seeing that already, and we're seeing that actually more from like small startups. I guess I don't really want to name names, but there's companies out there that are in the startup space, especially around like malware detection. We're seeing a lot of new products coming out that are applying machine learning, artificial intelligence to really move that ball forward when we're detecting malware on systems.
I got to interrupt you here.
Sure.
Data can tell you everything you need to know. That is a fact. Data has all that you need to know. The question is, can you interpret it And can you do the math to get the inferences out of it? And that's where the problem lies. So you and I have both been to a lot of these security conferences where the vendors are there and they're promising this, that, or the other. But I think you're right. The startups that really can have a math right. that draws the right inferences, that's where the money is.
Right.
You can name names of companies if you want to, or concepts that those companies are using.
So we did this three-part blog series on ransomware, and we looked at three aspects of ransomware. We looked at the prevalence across companies, that is, what proportion of companies have experienced ransomware. We looked at the proportion of companies actually paying the ransom, and then we also looked at the cost of paying that ransom. We started out trying to do the cost of the actual whole ransom event, but that level of specificity was not in the data. So we looked at just the cost of paying a ransom, the ransom cost. And what was interesting is that we took that very broad topic, those three specific aspects, and looked at all of the publications we could get our hands on. And what we did is we looked at a lot of them were surveys, and we had to be very careful about how we would analyze that data, because some companies would be like, if you got ransomware, would you pay the ransom, right? And that's a totally different question than you've been infected with ransomware. Did you pay, right? And so we'd be very careful, and we tried to filter out all of that stuff. And then we looked at essentially the size of the surveys, the results that they've gotten, and then we tried to combine them through a meta-analysis, doing different techniques and combining that. And so the end result is that we combined several different studies, several different surveys, and came up with the answers to these three questions and trying to look at the effect. And now since then, I've been watching these publications just sort of anecdotally, and it's definitely gotten worse over the last probably 12 months. And so we're going to look at updating that, trying to figure out how things have changed over the last 12 months. And so looking forward to that coming out probably next month.
Let's talk about the you pay ransomware situation, mm-hmm. because there are organizations that do pay, and there are situations where you might want to pay. So I'll just come up with a hypothetical. Let's just say you're a hospital and you get ransomware and you can't get access to patient data for emergency treatment or something like that, where there's a direct health implication that is imminent based on data and network connectivity. That is a huge problem. If you're in that situation, you might feel like you should just pay the ransomware so you can get your system and your data up, so that your internet connected device and your data for informed treatment can move forward. So that's one situation. It's a very hard situation to be in, and I think there's several cases where hospitals have paid the ransomware. And I know that there's at least one case, probably more, but where they paid the ransomware, and after that, they got a second payment request. So that's a problem. And ransomware threat actors, there's no guarantee that, number one, they'll give you your data back, and number two, that they haven't copied it.
Right.
But then again, if you're looking at the patient viewpoint, and that patient gets bad treatment or gets further ill or dies, they don't care about your ransomware problems. They just care that they're getting good treatment or that they don't die.
Right.
So it's a hard, how do you feel about those type of situations?
So I wish that there was a clean answer to give here. It's a very complicated question, right? Trying to decide if to pay, and under what circumstances should you pay? Of course, the FBI says never pay. It's essentially feeding the model. When companies are paying, that incentivizes the attacker to be like, oh, they're actually, people are making money with this ransomware thing. We should jump on board, right? And it becomes a bigger problem as companies continually pay. And, people, you mentioned how sometimes companies may pay and they either, they come back and request more money, or sometimes people pay and they still don't get their stuff back. But the attackers are incentivized to make that a good customer experience, oddly enough, right?
They are. I've heard that.
Yeah. And so they're very incentivized to do that. And when we looked at these surveys, there was a lot of variation, but it came out to about 40%, 41% of companies actually paid, which is a large, large proportion of companies.
I think from a business standpoint, these threat actors are organized and reasonably professional in their business model, meaning they're going to try to target a ransomware payment request that they think you can afford to pay.
Right.
That's less than
supply and demand.
That's less than the amount that you would have to pay an eForensics or a sophisticated consultancy to come in and do something. Because just like frivolous litigation, if there's frivolous litigation and the settlement cost is $5,000 to $10,000, that may be less than what it costs to hire an attorney.
Right.
And so that's the type of situation these companies are in, but they may come back for more. So it really is better to not pay it, but for in those life risk medical health situations where there's a direct tie-in.
Yeah. Yeah. And it comes down to a concept called tragedy of the commons, you know, which is where you've got some sort of shared resource. In this case, it's computing power. And if you choose to act selfishly and try to get your one situation back up online, you may make it worse for everybody else by doing that. But, you know, you mentioned cases where, you know, lives are on the line. I don't think many people would argue with trying to do the best that you can to save lives. I mean, that's a pretty hard thing to argue against.
Thanks so much for joining us for the Abstract Forward podcast. Like us on Facebook, tweet to us on Twitter, and check out our website at abstractforward.com. This is Jeremy Swenson signing off. We will catch you next time.